Blog Talk Radio.
Oh!
Good evening to our listeners of the Wise Women Media, the radio show on Blog Talk Radio on the Here Be Monsters Network. This is Anita Stewart. I wanted to say thanks first to our sponsors, which are Here Be Monsters, Roundtree 7, Daughters of Isis, The Hoodoo Blog, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, Florida Nature Photos, and you can find us at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. And also I want to remind you all, help keep us on the air every week. You can contribute to us at the WePay link at the top of the blog. This helps us pay for internet access, phone services, research, and the developing of a website for the radio show itself. Our main guest, Margie Clark, wasn't able to be with us tonight. I do have a couple of news stories that I can report on, and they're a little bit later in the show. We're going to have some local activists calling in to give us information about local events that are happening that people will want to know about. They'll talk a little bit about the XL pipeline, food and water safety, and Gaza, and quite a lot of other topics. So in the meantime, I'm going to hit us up with another song here, and we'll wait until everybody calls in, and I'll probably go over a few little news articles. So stay tuned.
Look out!
last two songs you heard, our opening song was Who Will Comfort Me by Melody Gardot, and this last song was The Sky Is Crying, which was made famous by Stevie Ray Vaughan, of course. It was an Elmore James song, and that was the Tedeschi Trucks Band doing that cover of that song. Since we did want to keep the topic on food safety, I was able to do a little searching, and I found a pretty interesting article that came out today. It was done by the blogger Fire Ant on the Broward Palm Beach New Times publication online. The title of the article is, Should Genetically Engineered Food Be Labeled? Florida Legislators Take Up the Cause. So if you want to look that up, that's fine, but there are a lot of local events happening in Tampa having to do with food and water safety. I'll read a few portions of this article since I found it quite timely. The turkey you ate yesterday was one of millions whose size is more than twice that of the bird your grandparents ate. Poultry farmers made that happen by careful breeding over the course of decades. The birds got so big that they couldn't screw, and farmers had to resort to artificial insemination to help the process along. But agriculture is totally corporate today, and Wall Street wants fast returns on its money. Not content with kinky barnyard sex, Big Food now uses bioscience to transfer genes among species, producing food whose effect on human health is controversial. Since genetic engineering is not disclosed on product labels, consumers have no idea what kind of scientific tinkering has been done to those apples, oranges, or turkeys they're about to ingest. The folks behind Food and Water Watch want to change that. Working in five districts throughout the state, Tampa, Tallahassee, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Palm Beach, their Let Me Decide campaign calls for legislation that would require labeling of GE foods in Florida. So this would be Florida's version of the Prop 37 that just got voted down in California. So let me move on. The Flavor Saver tomato was the first and most notorious of the so-called Frankenfoods. This was developed in 1994, by the way, shot up with flounder genes to extend shelf life. It was withdrawn after 3 years, though not out of concern for safety. Sweet corn, zucchini, and papaya are among the genetically engineered produce currently marketed in the United States. Genetic engineering is particularly pervasive among corn, soybeans, and sugar beets. Roughly 90% of U.S. production of these foods comes from GE crops. They make their way into our diets as cooking oils and ingredients in baked and other prepared foods. GE animals are not yet approved for human consumption, but their dairy and eggs are in circulation. And the feed they're raised on is largely made up of corn and soy meal that's already been genetically engineered. So there's concern over secondary effects on humans, which brings us back to yesterday's turkey. So that story is one of the many that are currently online. Again, that is at the Broward Palm Beach New Times in their blogs. The title of the article is Should Genetically Engineered Food Be Labeled? Florida Legislators Take Up the Cause. That was done by the blogger Fire Ant. And for people that are in Tampa, Tallahassee, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Palm Beach, I would be looking through public channels, probably on Facebook and other places, for events, continuing events that are going to be taking place that are hosted by Food and Water Watch. And you can also look up that website online. So I'll take you back to a little bit more music, and we'll go over a few more articles in just a little bit. We'll be right back. That was Mark Foster, Kimbra, and A-Track with the song Warrior. I was able to find a couple of other really good news articles. One that interested me a lot was the TEDx talks. And the one that I was looking at recently was called A World Without Cancer, John Andraka at the TEDx Redmond 2012. This just came out on YouTube just a couple of weeks ago. This young man seems to be pretty remarkable. There was also a Huffington Post article about what he had done. He was named the Gordon E. Moore Award winner at Intel ISEF 2012, basically the Olympics for high school science research, for his novel, Non-Invasive Paper Sensor to Detect Pancreatic, Ovarian, and Lung Cancer Before They Become Invasive, for only 3 cents and 5 minutes, no specialized training or bulky equipment needed. The sensor can also look at cancer drug resistance and how effective a cancer treatment is, and look at E. coli, salmonella, and rotavirus in food and water safety and blood-borne pathogens such as AIDS, HIV, and other STDs. In addition to the Moore Award, Jack also won the Google Award for solving a large and seemingly impossible problem with a simple solution with broad impacts. His prize money totals over $100,000. And even more remarkable is this young man is only 15 years old. There is a Huffington Post article, as I said before, that came out in May of this year. The title, John Andraka, 15, wins Intel Science Competition for Pancreatic Cancer Research. So we're going to hear a little bit about his invention, and if you have any questions about it or you want to call in and comment or you want to hit us up on the chat, go ahead and do that. Our call-in number is 213-816-0357, and we do have a caller, so let me pop them in here just a moment. Hello, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from? Hello? Hello? Hey, I'm not sure who this is. Hello? I'm going to say it one more. Ah, here we go, another call. Bear with me just a moment. Hello? For some reason, I'm not able to get you in. Try to call on the chat, or if you're using a cell phone, try doing a landline. And perhaps that'll work. In the meantime, I'm going to go back to this audio, and I'll try to pop in while the audio is playing, okay? Here goes.
That could detect cancer for less than 3 cents in 5 minutes. Imagine 168 times faster, over 26,000 times less expensive, and over 5 times more sensitive.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Jimmy from D.C.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Okay, so I've got you in on the 813 number, so it seems like it's working okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So this is Jimmy?
Yes. And Rain.
Hey, how are you? All right, good. Hey. Jimmy and Rain. Go ahead and fill us in on what you're doing. We were talking a little bit about food safety, but give us a rundown on some of the local events and things that are happening in the local area. But, you know, hit us up with the food and safety first, okay?
Okay, yeah, tomorrow, Saturday, there's a protest in solidarity with the Coalition of Mockery Workers. They're fighting for fair food. There's still cases of modern-day slavery here in Florida, and on a daily basis, farm workers are exploited, and so they're rising up demanding that they be treated with respect and dignity. And so there's going to be an action against Publix calling on them to support the Coalition of Unlawful Workers. And you can find more information about that at ciw-online.org.
Can you tell us what is – now, I know I attended a protest several years ago about the tomatoes, and it was like the 5 cents more, I think, a bushel of tomatoes. And it was a
penny more per
huge
pound.
Test on the corner. I think it was a Bush and 40th. There's a Publix there. So there was a large, large demonstration. Can you tell us, can you give us an update on what's been happening with the Immokalee workers and why they are still protesting this? This has been going on for quite some time.
Yes. So they started their campaign against Taco Bell. They moved on to McDonald's and Burger King, went through the fast food companies, Subway, Pizza Hut. They all got on board, and then they're now going after grocery stores. And they got Trader Joe's, they got Chipotle just, you know, a few weeks ago, signed to their Fair Food Agreement, which basically just says that they're going to pay one penny more per pound, which in some cases actually doubles their wages.
Of the farm workers.
Yeah, and institute a code of conduct so that it's guaranteed that there's no slavery in their supply chain. And the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, with their allies, are now taking aim at the supermarket industry and asking them to be part of the solution, too.
So it's kind of like, it kind of reminds me of that sign that you see sometimes in some of the little things on Facebook. It says, "I can't believe we're still protesting this shit." It's like, it's just going on and on and on year after year, and these people just don't seem to be getting what they justly deserve, you know, and
Publix
it's just over and over again. So I hope there's a logical solution. If you guys have the audio on, let me suggest that you turn it down because it's easier to hear and talk. Because there is maybe a 5 second lag between our voices and what comes over the air, so that might help you a little bit.
Okay.
Does that work? Heard the echo, and I thought, oh, that's probably like really confusing you guys. So, tell us a little bit more about something local, and then we can hit up what's going on with the tar sands and the pipeline, of course.
This was Buy Nothing Day and also Walmart Solidarity Day. There's workers in Walmart who are striking today to demand, you know, better treatment, better wages. A lot of times when they're organizing, they're being fired or otherwise punished, and they're just demanding their rights to organize and to better themselves. There was an action in St. Petersburg, banner drop and demonstration at the Walmart in Pinellas Park. And also, there was a bunch of signs that were put up at local malls and Walmart and Best Buys that said, it had a picture of a Grinch, and with it, it was a quote by the Grinch that said, maybe Christmas doesn't come from a store, maybe Christmas perhaps means a little bit more. And these kind of actions demonstrate that there are other ideals out there that don't center around greed, around self-interest, around consumerism, that a different way of relating to each other is possible.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and it's really a whole way of, in this economy, of just relearning how to celebrate the holidays, that you don't need the things and the accoutrements and the decorations and all this craziness. To me, it's the holidays are becoming more like family and close friend gatherings, and it's a time to really take part in one another versus having things and keeping up with the Joneses and, you know, your Christmas lights are better than my Christmas lights type thing. So I'm finding it much more rewarding and relaxing. What do you all think about that?
I mean, I think that I've been a big supporter of Buy Nothing Day for quite a long time, and my family doesn't celebrate with presents anymore as a result, although my mom still insists on giving us stocking stuffers full of candy, which is fine. I can accept that. But for the most part, we don't do that anymore. You know, we talked about it as a family, and we, you know, just decided that it wasn't really an investment that we thought was worthwhile.
Right.
And it,
right.
It wasn't benefiting anyone, and it wasn't really, it was just some habitual thing, really, that we were doing. And I think that that sort of critique should be had between families, you know, because you always have people trying to mitigate the impact anyway of the holidays on their families anyway, doing things like, you know, nobody spends more than $20 on each other and things like that. And what's the point of even doing that? To spend that $20 on gas and get together somewhere really nice and hang out, you know?
Yeah, or spend it on the dinner that you all can have together, which really is, it's more of a gift because those become long-lasting memories as far as I'm concerned. You know, that's how
yeah.
it is with family anyway. And
absolutely.
We stopped exchanging gifts probably about, maybe 10 years ago. And it wasn't because, at the time, it wasn't because we were, you know, protesting anything and we didn't want to make a point. We just could no longer afford it. And
mm-hmm.
and we weren't about to go into debt to do it. It just
right.
didn't make any sense. And
yeah.
I feel very good about making that decision and sticking with it all these years. And, yeah, I went to Thanksgiving yesterday and spent a wonderful time with my sister. And that's a memory I'll carry with me for a lifetime. So to me, that's more important, is that quality time, you know. And
yes,
and definitely the point made is when you watch television, like I watched a little bit of the news tonight. I don't watch TV that often, but I saw the craziness at the stores, and it's just ridiculous. While people in our own community are really having a rough time and can't buy groceries, I just think of all this wasteful spending, it just kind of really upsets me that people are going without even food, you know, or keeping their lights on or, you know, anything like that. So anyway, that's where I'm at with it. And I agree with you entirely. It's there's more ways to spend the holiday, more meaningful. So, but tell us any updates. I don't know if you all are with Tampa Food Not Bombs, but did they do anything that you know of for the boycott of Walmart and the other stores today?
A lot of people involved with Food Not Bombs are also involved with Occupy and with a lot of the other groups in the area, and a lot of people in the area have gone to Walmart actions and other anti-consumerist Buy Nothing Day actions in the Tampa Bay area. But
uh-huh.
nothing specifically Food Not Bombs.
Did they have a lot of people walk off the jobs today?
I haven't heard any numbers being reported, but I haven't really been online much today either. I hadn't seen any pictures of walkouts. I'd seen mostly pictures of people outside standing in solidarity. That's mostly what I've been seeing reported, so I'm not really sure. Have you heard
mm-hmm.
anything?
And now, have either of you gone to any of the actions in regards to the XL pipeline? Or do you know people that are there?
So there are some people from the area, like regional area, that have gone out that way in solidarity. And there's definitely, there was a banner drop on USF campus that some people did last week for the XL pipeline in solidarity. And there's been some actions around the state regionally, like small actions. Last year, I was in D.C. around the same time as the Occupy event. It was the last day of the Keystone hearings before they were going to determine whether or not they were going to do another environmental impact assessment. And there was a lot of mobilization happening to push for them to get another one at that time. That was around the same time as Occupy was really starting to get together in D.C. And so pretty much, yeah, what's going on with that, as far as the people that were from this area, is still being figured out. But they're out there. And, yeah, I think everyone should be really conscious of this issue because it's really important for everyone in the long term. It's not just something happening in Texas. It's something, it's a lot greater, and it affects all of us in a much greater way than everyone is really, considering. I think the discussion right now, mostly around the pipeline, is domestic oil supply and security and job creation, and a lot of that is severe propaganda, and that should really be discussed in the media, is what it should be, really.
Tell our listeners what you mean by propaganda in regards to the message that we're getting from, like, ads on television and job creation. A lot of these, I know a lot of the propaganda is coming from, you know, it's becoming a very political issue. But tell us some of the messaging that you've been hearing in regards to why domestic oil supply is acceptable.
Okay, well, acceptable. I mean, it would be great if we, I mean, I don't think anyone disputes that being sustainable and being able to produce all that you need for yourself, and that can include putting those boundaries around something called a nation, being sustainable, I don't think anyone would argue that that's a benefit. However, with regards to just specifically the Keystone XL pipeline, TransCanada is a Canadian company. Any profit that gets made is going to their stakeholders, who are not necessarily even American shareholders, and they're definitely not an American company. So people that like to argue that viewpoint, that's already not the case. It's not an American company. It's not benefiting America in that way. And when I say benefiting America, we're discussing the fact that in order for the Keystone Pipeline to pass in the first place, because it crosses an international border between Canada and the United States, the president has to sign off a presidential permit. It also has to pass all the other types of regulations, like the environmental impact assessments and everything like that. However, it absolutely has to have the presidential permit, and that requires the president somehow agreeing that the pipeline is in the best interest of the people of this country, or whatever project it is that requires that sort of presidential permit. So they have to prove that the pipeline is in the best interest of this country. So what they like to say is things like, well, we'll be secure because we'll have a domestic supply of fuel, of oil. That would be true if it was a domestic supply. It may be coming from somewhere nearby, but it's not coming from the U.S. It's coming from Alberta. The tar sands that it's pumping the oil from is in Canada. It's a Canadian company. They're only building a pipeline across our entire country, proposed entire country through six states, across an aquifer that provides like 80% of the drinking water for that region, and also a lot of the water that's used for irrigation. It's like the breadbasket of America. It would cross that entire area, and all it would do is create 5,000 temporary jobs. They quoted a lot more jobs at the beginning last year when they were really trying to push this project through. But there were studies that were done by different universities that showed that these jobs would not be long-term, that they were temporary, and that long-term would pretty much be non-existent. Because, I mean, what you're talking about is building a pipeline. It doesn't require anyone to man the pipeline. It's monitored by sensors. That's why response times are often slow, and you don't even know that something – that you don't even have a response sometimes when there's leaks. Like, there was leaks a couple years ago at one of the pipelines of the way that the first Keystone was built, and they didn't respond for, you know, hours because nobody's there to see it. So the fact that you're creating these jobs is a myth. The fact that the oil or whatever fuel it is, in this case, the tar sands, is going to stay in this country to benefit the people of this country is also a myth. It's getting sent to a refinery that's in this country. That does not mean that the oil is staying in this country. That means that it's getting refined here and then getting shipped out to whoever the client is that has bought the oil. that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to the U.S. and benefiting us. So really, we're just taking all of the risk with this project, because the risk is leaks, and the risk is leaks in really sensitive areas of land that are either agricultural or sensitive areas, for example, the sand hills of Nebraska, which was a really big issue for a lot of people in that state when they were trying to push it through last year. Everyone in Florida is familiar with the sandhill cranes. We see them all around. Everybody knows you're not supposed to mess with them. They're endangered or they're protected. They come from that area. That's their nesting ground, is in the sandhills. The pipeline is proposed to cross that entire area. It's called the sandhills because it's very porous, sandy soil, which means it infiltrates really quickly whatever goes onto the surface, i.e. like water. Or if there's a leak from a pipeline, all of that oil, which means that it infiltrates quickly through the soil and gets into the lower aquifer quickly, which means it contaminates the aquifer quickly. So if there's a leak, that's a really serious problem, which is why the first environmental impact assessment statement got thrown out, because it basically claims that there would be no impact, which was fairly ridiculous. Second,
we saw a lot of this happening during the Gulf oil spill, and all of that really is still happening to the people that are living in the Gulf region. The environmental, I call it ecocide, terracide, and genocide, because that's exactly it is. When you're affecting somebody's food and water supply, that's a crime. That's a crime against humanity.
Absolutely.
And this obviously isn't going to quit. And unfortunately, the Americans that are listening to the news reports every night are totally brainwashed about, you know, I know on the Republican side they were thinking, well, you know, the oil should be kept at home, the oil and natural gas, and, you know, we need to not fight these wars in the Middle East because we can get our energy right from here. Well, you know, they're not living in the Gulf region or in some of these places.
Right.
They don't. What's happening in the poor communities, which inevitably this is where this, you know, pipeline is going to go through. Farmers and poor neighborhoods and poor areas and people, and eminent domain plays a big factor in this too, as we all know.
It does play a big factor. They're using it right now with the section of the pipeline that's being built, that the blockade, the tar sands blockade that's been happening for about 2 months now, is really focusing on the section of the pipeline that doesn't require the presidential permit. It's only crossing a few states to get to basically link an existing pipeline to the refinery that they're trying to build the XL pipeline all the way across to, which they still need the permit for. So focusing on that pipeline is because that pipeline really only requires the state's permission, and the state can go ahead and use eminent domain saying that it's in the best interest of the state for them to do that because of revenue, opportunity, whatever. So that's an issue that those people and those property owners have to bring up with their own state. It's not yet a federal issue in that case, although eminent domain can be used federally. So that's really been the focus there, although the bigger focus is really not the eminent domain issue, because the eminent domain issue also requires them proving that it's in the best interest of the country and the people, and they still have to show that. And if there's not jobs and there's not oil and all we're doing is taking on the risk, and all we're doing is not only that but increasing risk globally for everybody by increasing the amount of carbon emissions, by clear-cutting, by digging, by mining, by burning all of these fuels, you know, and by using all of this fresh water, which is needed to process all of these fuels and to ship all of these things and to make all of these processes happen, and we're using, contaminating, and disposing of that water, never getting it back. We're reducing our supply of everything that we absolutely need for things that we're telling ourselves that we need, like this increase of supply of oil. Why, for example, is the government, instead of saying, yeah, this is really in the best interest of the people, we really need this oil, because we all need oil, right? We need the lights on. Okay, well, why is the government not then instead passing some sort of tax break or incentive for these ranchers to be able to host solar panel companies, large arrays on their land, instead of allowing a pipeline to come through? Or, you know, putting wind turbines up in their property instead of, like, allowing a pipeline through. If they were able to have an incentive to do it, then they would do it. But instead, they're getting these pipeline companies coming through, offering them really ambiguous contracts that don't have a lot of discussion about liability with regards to leaks and things like that, but for a decent amount of money, and these people are signing it. And, you know, some of them that aren't signing it are getting eminent domain because everybody else signed it, and so they're the last piece of the puzzle, you know?
Right, right. We're actually, it's pretty bad when our own people are so out of touch with what's happening. And then when you try to talk to them about something like this topic, exactly, it's a good example. You're talking to them about it, and they're calling you a conspiracy theorist. And I'm telling people, you know, this is happening to people right now. You know, there's people sitting in trees trying to protect their land. And,
right.
You know, they're going like, what planet are you from? You know, that's not happening. That's not true. What are you listening to? Did you get that online? And I get that all the time. I get that all the time when I talk to people. They just want to believe
the best
it.
Place to get news, it would be online, because you can compare more sources that way. You know, you can
yeah.
get sources from all over the world. You don't have to just stick to whatever cable news source that, you know, basically owns five other of the same channels that you're watching. I mean, that's just a bad argument in the first place.
Yeah, and it's almost to the point of they've taken that term and just used it and abused it, and they can use that term for anything that they don't want to hear about or they don't want to believe in. And I find that really quite disheartening, and that's why I see more and more of a divide between I don't want to call it Republican-Democrat, because I'm at the point now where I don't think it really matters what party anybody's in. It's their ideology and what they believe in, and it's just looking like there's such a divide about what's real and what isn't real and what people believe in. And it's really, to me, at this point, it looks dangerously close to a two-sided argument, no matter what. No matter what you're discussing, it's a two-sided argument. What do you think about the people that actually took this to another level after the election and signed up to secede from the union? I'm sure
the
you
different
won't.
States?
Or
yeah,
the
different
there were a whole bunch of different states that, you know,
yeah.
signed up.
I thought it was kind of entertaining. I really didn't have much of a response besides that. That's about as realistic as anybody else from any other small faction political party believing that they're going to get the government to be gone, you know, like, or to change the way that the government is in existence right now in any kind of reasonable time frame. It's just funny. It's not going to happen.
My take on it was a little bit different. I guess I'm different than the herd in this. In that I believe in the Constitution, I believe in, you know, our founding fathers and how they put our government together with the checks and balances. Actually, it was patterned after, you know, the Iroquois Nation. And I find it interesting that I believe that if people want to secede from the Union and they want to build that kind of movement, that's something that perhaps should be looked at. I mean, Vermont has had a huge secessionist movement for quite some time. That's one state.
I mean, but that's
New Hampshire,
my point. Is,
you
but
know.
That's kind of my point, is that they have had those movements for a long time. And I'm not saying that that's not their right to do it, or that it's not even necessarily a good idea, you know, or anything like that. I mean, I'm not having an opinion with regards to that at all. I'm just saying, you know, I mean, they can make that effort, and with whatever their argument is, I mean, some of the states that I think we're trying to secede, I think we're doing it for pretty, like, honestly, some of them racist reasons, but that's my opinion. You know, I just think that regardless of whatever the state's reason is for secession, in any case, people have and states have been trying to push this for years, and it's not, I mean, nothing's happened, and it's not going to happen, because for the same reason that, and, you know, we'll go ahead and say, like, let's assume that I was a quote-unquote self-proclaimed anarchist, for the same reason that having somebody that's an anarchist say that we're going to overthrow the state, like, in the next, you know, 10 years, it's, most people are going to laugh at that statement and look at you like you're crazy. And that's probably a reasonable critique on a lot of levels. It might be disheartening, but it's still probably a reasonable critique. And I would say the same thing about state secession. You know, like, it might be a reasonable ideal to go for, but I don't think that it's necessarily something in a time frame that's realistic, that, you know, there aren't bigger things that we should be worried about in a smaller time frame, I guess.
Right, and I really enjoyed the back and forth on the topic, but it didn't seem like enough people were talking about that and talking about, you know, some type of logical solution. You know,
right.
What is going to make us live better and have better government, you know?
You know, something that I really am a big fan of and advocate, and what I believe real democracy, however you want to define that, consensus-based or representative or however you want to define it, I feel like the way that real democracy, in my opinion, is like direct democracy, so everyone's involved. And the only way that that can happen is that if you have small communities, and small, of course, being a relative term nowadays with regards to the scale and scope of cities and communities. However, you know, transition town movements, intentional communities, eco-villages, communities where the governance is maintained within a small enough group of people where everyone's informed and participatory, and where the scale of the community is such that you can really maintain and sustain yourself and the level of resources that you need either on site or within the near region with, you know, a reasonable small-scale economy. I really feel that even if there were to be a larger governing body, kind of like original constitutional style, that really the way for everyone to have a better future, I guess, is for there to be less of this concept of global trade free market and more of this small scale community local focus, because that really reduces the amount of footprint as far as your consumption goes, and your production of waste and the energy that you need, the resources that you need for transportation, for everything. And those resources could be available for other things that we might, you know, I don't think anyone is saying that they want to give up computers or cars tomorrow, or water for showers, for example. However, if we keep using the resources the way that we're using them, and thinking that we can just ship things here and there and everywhere, make one part here, ship it to another country to get assembled into some small, a larger part that gets sent somewhere else to be finalized into a larger constructed part, that's ridiculous. It's not efficient. And, you know, that's a failure on every level, from a business perspective, from a design perspective, from an environmental perspective. From every perspective, this whole entire structure of economy that we have is a massive fail. And the way to really get back to basics is to localize it and really have a true supply and demand system. Because what we have now is kind of like a created supply and demand system, and advertising, media, and all of that plays a huge role in creating that perception for people.
So do you think, and this is a question I'm just throwing out there because I'm you know, I'm open to anybody's opinion on this. Do you think that the far-reaching tentacles of our government at the federal level have really, we've become too big for them to control? And they're really just, this is their last desperate attempt to control, but they really can't. What is your take on
that? You mean
like
with all the crackdowns on
yeah,
free speech and movement and the internet?
Right.
And I think that the future instability is what's really motivating that, actually. I think part of what you're saying is true with regards to the people have become a large amount, really a huge quantity, and, you know, population is increasing, you know, the populace is increasing. But I think that really a driving factor in passing a lot of these things, a lot of these, power moves, right, like abilities to be able to, like, put the smack down, really, with, like, the law if they need to, without a lot of oversight or red tape.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that we have, for example, depleted, like, something like 98% of the rare earth metals that are easily accessible on the planet, and rare earth metals are things that we use in every single electronic piece of equipment that we produce, for computers, for cars, for anything, and also in things like solar panels and medical equipment and things that we use every day that we really, really need. But we've depleted like 90% of that on the planet. And the place that has the majority of the remaining rare earth metals happens to be China. So you can see where I'm going with that kind of like economic and resource instability. That's also with regards to water. We're running out of water really quickly. We're contaminating water really quickly, and that's going to be a huge problem. So you're going to have these resource grabs, wars, whatever you want to call them, and that's really going to cause, like, a lot of instability, like what you're seeing right now in Europe with the austerity measures, and people that are, you know, when you have nothing, you do what you have to do to get what you need, and that's what's happening, and that's what they're scared of, I think, really. I think they see I feel like they see what's coming, basically. It's imminent what's coming, this kind of collapse, however dire you think the collapse is that's coming, there's going to be some sort of collapse that's inevitable because we're running out of stuff. So however you see that coming, it's happening, and they're preparing for it in one way or another. The hurricane with Sandy is a really good example because it opened up the discussion a lot after the debates with regards to climate change. And people are talking about how, oh, you know, maybe this will make people wake up and they'll realize that climate change is real and they'll start addressing it. Okay, well, that in itself is a lie. Because if you look at places like New York, Philadelphia, and all of these other cities that are kind of coastal or that have, like, large rain seasons, they've been preparing for climate change for, like, 5-10 years. They've been increasing their sewer sizes for increased volumes of water that they're going to have as runoff because of increased flows of rain. They've been creating permeable concrete so that there's increased infiltration so that there's less flooding. You know, they're doing all of these things, preparing for all of these things that they're telling you in the media isn't real, because that's where the debate is in the politosphere. Like, it's crazy.
I see that the coastal, I had an, it was a very alarming series of photos, and it came to me through a friend that happened to look at an Australian ABC report, and it was the coolest series of photos in the fact of how you were able to look at the before and after, because it was, how can I put it, interactive. But the photos were aerial photos of different neighborhoods affected by Sandy.
Mm.
You could take your cursor and just move the before photo over like a drape, like you were just like draping it to the left. And you could see the same aerial photo now. So you could see how there were like rivulets of water that just actually washed over certain areas, intercoastal areas, and how bridges were covered. And I said to myself as I looked at these photos, and I've had some experience looking at aerial photos and satellite imagery when I was in the Air Force, so it was easy for me to pinpoint specific things. And I thought, these people can't even go back and rebuild in some of these areas. Because the water has literally reclaimed portions of the land. And there's no way you can dredge it out because it's on the ocean. So it's literally like the coastline has completely changed in those areas. And somebody else told me this. They told me coastlines, scientifically, coastlines change every 150 years. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Rain, but St. John's Pass in St. Petersburg was one such area that was changed with a huge, massive hurricane that came through in 1859, I think it was. It was unnamed. And it completely changed St. Pete Beach as we know it now, but back then it was pretty much wilderness. And it completely changed the coastline. So I thought to myself, this is in 1859, and the coastlines change every 150 years. What the hell's coming up for, you know, Clearwater, St. Pete, Tarpon Springs area? Because, you know, we've been dodging some big bullets lately with storm surge and storms in general. You know, we're way past the 150-year mark.
That's
so
true.
I'm thinking, and I thought about this when the four hurricanes came through in 2004. I thought, where are people going to go?
Yeah.
You know, they evacuated with the first one, which was Charlie, and then they went into the center of the state, a lot of people that were evacuating, but then they got hit with the storm in the center of the state.
Yeah.
So in Florida, there's really nowhere to go. You can hunker down. You can go 20 or 30 miles inland. But if that water reclaims the land, like, for instance, if it did on Clearwater Beach, there would be no Clearwater Beach left. That would be destroyed with a 15-foot storm surge.
It would, absolutely.
Surge. So, you know, I've looked at all these things. It's one of the reasons why I moved inland in 2000. I moved inland because I didn't want to be by the coastal area anymore. But people that are buying property and people that live, you know, by the coastlines, they need to think about these things before they invest their money in property because the times they are a-changing, they're changing quick. And
I mean, and that's true. And they really should think about it. Even if climate change wasn't as big of a threat as it is right now, it would still be not the wisest thing to do to build on a coastline because even without the 150-year rule that your friend was telling you, the coastlines are changing all the time. I mean, the waves specifically are supposed to change the coast. It takes some parts of the sand and takes it down to another area. It's just a natural process that happens. And that's why they have to dredge along the coast all the time now because that natural erosion process is inhibited by the buildings. The buildings create a natural constraint, so it stops there, and it basically just drops off like a cliff. It can't keep depositing, so it just stops. And that's why they have to keep dredging and adding the sand back to the beaches every year along the entire coast of Florida. I watched them do it during New Year's Eve last year in Panama City, and it was intense. I was like, wow. I hadn't really seen it that up close before. It was pretty weird. It's all the sand getting...
Another thing they do up in the panhandle that a lot of people aren't aware of, that you and this might be have been part of what you were seeing, is they're actually covering up the sand that's been affected by oil, too. And they're covering up...
Yeah, I have heard about that.
They're covering up, you know, tar balls that are washing up in the panhandle as well, basically all the way down to Big Bend. So the sand has literally been sifted through and the beaches have been re-sanded to cover up the crimes of the big oil companies that have completely destroyed the area, destroyed the environment. And, you know, people are sick. People are sick, and this award that BP gave, $4.5 billion, I think. I don't know how much of that is going to the human impact, and I would dare say probably not much because BP will not admit that they have caused people to be ill.
Well, they did just admit to criminal charges, technically.
Criminal charges, but not to the human impact. Not to people, thousands.
That's true.
people.
You're right. The, technically, the admission is only towards the maintenance and operation, I believe. You're right.
Yeah, right. Now, what I know you and Jimmy have been probably connecting with a lot of the Occupy people in Tampa. I have not been able to get down there. But can you give us kind of an update? Because a lot of people think that Occupy, the Occupy movement, is behind us now, that it's old news. Can you give us kind of a running commentary on what's happening with Occupy Tampa in general and any other Occupy movements that you've been connecting with?
Well, Occupy Tampa was getting together some things along with Tampa Food Not Bombs to send up to Occupy Sandy for the hurricane relief. And a lot of occupations are definitely still mobile and definitely still active. And a lot of them have actually been sending things up to New York and New Jersey to help out. Occupy Gainesville as well has been organizing. And there's been several Walmart solidarity protests that were held in the Gainesville and Tampa areas that Occupies were involved with. I would say that just like most things, if people haven't heard about it, they're just not looking at the news close enough. It's in there somewhere if you look for it because, you know, I know WMNF has reported on it and a couple other places. So there's definitely news out there about different actions that Occupy has been involved with. I believe that there might be some really neat messages with lights appearing around the Tampa area soon as people keep their eyes open and keep looking up.
Interesting. Is anybody going to be photos of these things?
There have been a few photos posted. I'll have to send you a few if you haven't seen them yet.
Post them to my wall on Facebook and I'll send them around.
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely people of the Tampa area, St. Pete, Tampa, Clearwater area, keep your eyes open and keep them open at night for pretty lights with messages.
I know that people are finally starting to get the fact that when they're sending money and assistance up to these areas that have been affected by anything, storms, you know, earthquakes, whatever, they're starting to question where their money goes, and I thought to myself, well, it's about time, you know, because you see these big ads on the TV screen, you know, the Red Cross, and all of them jump into it, donate, call this number, text to this number, and it's really interesting to see that people are finally starting to follow the money, because I saw, to me, just watching the posts on Facebook and the pictures that were posted, I was able to see that the local churches and Occupy Sandy were doing more for the victims of Hurricane Sandy than it seemed that anybody else was doing.
Right.
What's your take on that?
Well, so for me, this all goes back to, again, the small-scale community and really people being able to take care of things for themselves. With regards to, like, larger organizations, I don't discount the fact that for large crises and disaster relief, you do need large-scale organizations to come in, for example, with large-scale equipment to be able to do large projects and really take care of those things. But when you're talking about the human aspect, when you're talking about neighborhoods that have been impacted, what people really need to see are familiar faces. What people really need to see are people that they can trust, that, you know, they can count on, not some person with a name tag that some aid worker that just agrees and complies to whatever they say that they need and yeah, we'll get it for you later. The thing with Occupy Sandy and what a lot of even the larger news media was picking up on was that what was happening in these areas was that the people that were organizing in these neighborhoods were generally from these neighborhoods or around these neighborhoods, or at least were hooking up with the people in these neighborhoods that were the point people that could help them send them out to places that needed it. And what they would do is go specifically ask individuals face-to-face, what do you need? Here's an address. Go here for this is where we're collecting stuff for people. Or, you know, okay, give me your number. as soon as we find something, we're going to write your name down. We'll come back here and we'll give it to you, whatever. You know, they were doing direct organizing, and they were actually being accountable for what they were saying they were going to do. It wasn't just somebody with a role that did this aspect, and then it got passed off to another person, and somebody's get, you know, it gets lost in the process. This was just directly happening on the street with people that saw faces every day and could go back to those same faces and, you know, could trust that. And it's really about being able to have that direct access and not have all the red tape in between that ties it up. People are capable of organizing for themselves. It's crazy to think that they need assistance in doing this. It's just stuff that they need. If they have stuff and tools, generally people will take care of things. That's the human, you know, initiative, I feel.
Is there anything else that you wanted our listeners to know about what's going on in Tampa over the next month or so, or any projected plans for December?
Well, not in Tampa. Tomorrow we have a Gaza solidarity protest.
Good.
Orlando on Sunday is the big statewide one, just to stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza who are, the truce is uneven right now, and even if this latest outbreak in the fighting didn't occur, Gaza is still under siege. There's an open air prison. They don't have the right to move around. They don't have the ability to get supplies in. Even the siege, it's a jail. It's a prison. And this is not just in Gaza, in the West Bank too. The Israelis control everything and block off Palestinians so they can't even reach their families and loved ones. It's really a tragedy, and we're just going to show up tomorrow in Tampa at Fowler and 56th around 3:00, and then in Orlando on Sunday just to voice our compassion and respect and just to show the world that people do care, show Palestinians that even if they feel alone, that there's some people on this side of the world that
how can people find out about these two actions? The one tomorrow is in Temple Terrace, I believe. What do people need to do to get more information about that?
They can go to stpeteforpeace.org. It's a local anti-war group. And then for the Orlando action, I don't know if it is on a website. You can Google it, though. Google Orlando statewide Gaza. You'll find something.
Well, I'm really thankful that you guys came on the air with me tonight, and we probably should do these updates a little bit more often. But I really wanted to get information out to people, especially during the holiday season. You know, some people aren't working as much. They have more spare time. They can probably attend some of these events and actions, whereas when they're working pretty steady, they can't. And anytime you want to be on the show, just, you know, give me a holler if you've got something you want to announce or community announce.
And not only join other actions, but start their own. You know, we all are passionate about different things. So if any of your listeners have an issue that they feel passionately about, you know, all they have to do is start something, and people will join.
And I did want to let you all know, because I know Rain mentioned Transition Town. We are official Transition Tampa.
Transition Tampa.
Yeah, Transition Tampa is now official, and I'm on the steering committee myself. So we have a Transition Town on Facebook. It's Transition Tampa, if you look it up. And we're putting together a website now, and we're planning some events for probably after the January 1st. We have a movie series that we're going to be doing and quite a lot of other things. So there's going to be more announcements about our events and what's happening. So we want to get the whole community involved. And, of course, develop alliances along the way. So, but I did want to let you all know
support.
About it.
I'm in full support of Transition Tampa. I liked you already.
Yeah, so this is going to be really cool, and I'm very excited about it too, you know. So I really just completely, totally promote the books, you know, the Transition Town book, and then now there's a Transition Companion, which is a new book. And I ask people to read that so they can get an idea on what the transition movement is about. And, of course, at what degree do they want to be involved, you know.
Right.
So thank you so much, Rain and Jimmy, for being on. And
thank you.
Come back on, and hope you had a great holiday weekend. And I wish I could tell you that I was going to be able to go to the event tomorrow, but I can't. I have to work, but there's other events coming, and I will definitely be on board. So you all have a great rest of the weekend.
You too. Have a good one.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. So I want to thank Jimmy and Rain for being on the show. I did want to go back to our quick video with this young man, Jack Andraka, as he talks about his really marvelous invention on how to detect cancer, 15 years old. So I'm going to let this fly. Here goes.
So there I am. But, that was the entire talk. Bye. So we've been talking a lot about this thing called cancer, and it's really near and dear to all of us. But imagine a world without cancer. What if there was a sensor that was like a diabetes test strip that could detect cancer for less than 3 cents in 5 minutes? Imagine 168 times faster, over 26,000 times less expensive, and over 400 times more sensitive. Well, I created such a strip, and basically I was motivated to do this because I had a close family member that passed due to pancreatic cancer. And it's a really devastating disease. It's a death sentence, basically. You can see that after 5 years, only 5.5% of people who are initially diagnosed will survive. And that is a staggering statistic. Why, as a society that is so technologically advanced, could this statistic be acceptable to us? So then I got really interested, and I started doing a bit of research. And what I found is that there are these certain proteins that are found in your blood at higher concentrations when you have pancreatic cancer. And I was looking at one called mesothelin. It's highly overexpressed by pancreatic cancer, and as well as the early stages, where if you can find it in those early stages, then has close to 100% survival rate rather than 5.5%. But also, a main problem with our current diagnostic test for pancreatic cancer is grossly inaccurate. It diagnoses, like, for example, inflammation of your pancreas. And that, to me, is unacceptable. A 70% sensitivity and less than that for specificity, meaning it gives tons of false positives and false negatives. And so then there are these really cool things called carbon nanotubes. And what these are they're the superheroes of material science. They're these atomic tubes of carbon, and they have these fantastic properties. So I'm super interested in that. And then I began formulating an idea in an unlikely place, biology class. And we were learning about antibodies, which are basically locking key molecules that bind specifically to a certain protein. In this case, the cancer biomarker mesothelin. So then I had an idea. I was reading this paper in biology class, and I also knew about carbon nanotubes, and I knew about this protein mesothelin, and we were learning about antibodies. So it's kind of like connect the dots puzzle where you form a giraffe, but in this case it's like a sensor. And so here's the idea I came up with. You have a network of the single-walled carbon nanotubes and antibodies. So what happens is when you put a blood sample that contains that target protein in it on this network, that protein will go into the network and form a larger molecule with that antibody, and what this causes an electrical change in the sensor. And I can actually measure this with a $50 ohm meter from Home Depot. And it's really, like, easy to produce. All you do is you create uniform dispersion of these, like you mix it up kind of, with these carbon nanotubes and this antibody. And you just dip the, like a piece of filter paper. It's really, really simple. And then you dry it and you do this 13 times. That's not that hard. And you just measure it with this $50 ohmmeter. It requires less than a sixth of a drop of blood. So it's a tiny prick to your finger. And so what you have to do for detecting a disease such as pancreatic cancer, when a protein is overexpressed, you have to set a cutoff level. If it's above this, then it's at an abnormally high level. If it's below that, then it's kind of normal and you're okay. So I chose mine as 10 nanograms per ml. And a nanogram is a tiny amount. Think of it as 1 billionth. So pretty small. Okay. So then essentially what I did is I had to test whether my sensor was actually working. And so I took about 100 patients who had pancreatic cancer ranging in its stage, and you can see they're all above this 20 nanograms. That's well above the 10 nanogram per ml cutoff. So I had 100% sensitivity. Then I had negative cancer samples, healthy patients, people who did not have pancreatic cancer, maybe some other condition. And those are all below 10 nanograms per ml. That means that's not giving any false positives or any false negatives. That means 100% accuracy in its diagnosis. And this has the potential to save thousands of lives, reshaping how we think of cancer diagnostics. But in addition to this, what happens is it's also, I found, it could look at how effective a chemotherapeutic treatment or regimen, as well as how effective your surgery is. You can see here that for each of the different chemotherapeutic drugs, I tested 5 on mouse models, they all have different levels of mesothelin. So it could effectively see how effective your cancer drug treatment is. So it could look at drug resistance, for example. And so with this, I created a sensor that can detect pancreatic cancer. And it's very simple. It's very rapid, taking 5 minutes for 3 cents. It's non-invasive, it's sensitive, and selective. But in addition, compared to the current gold standard of pancreatic cancer detection, it's 168 times faster, over 26,000 times less expensive, and over 400 times more sensitive. And that's not actually including that you need specific practice and, like, university training in order to conduct that gold standard, as well as it requires these expensive, bulky machines to read this thing called ELISA. Well, mine is a $50 ohm meter from Home Depot. And then also the protein I'm detecting called mesothelin is overexpressed in both ovarian and lung cancer. This sensor is a generic sensor for those two cancers, but also implications are that that certain protein is found in 40 different types of cancer. This sensor is detecting nearly every form of cancer. And this has limitless applications. What happens is you just change this antibody in the sensor, and you can detect anything, any protein. That means other forms of cancer, other diseases such as E. coli, rotavirus, salmonella, as well as HIV, AIDS, all these cancers and diseases that plague us. Thousands, millions, billions of lives can be saved with this technology. And then also, it can look at how effective a treatment is. This will reshape how we think of medicine. We will now have a simple diabetic test strip that can detect your disease in 5 minutes with 3 cents, but also tell you how to optimally cure the disease and treat it. And so, oh, 2 slides are missing. Well, my final conclusion, what I'm going to leave with, is that I'm not the only one who can do this. Anyone can. It just took me 200 emails and a bunch of hard work to do it, but that's a different story. You just have to ask yourself, imagine a world, or what if? And then you can become like me and hopefully have a very happy running up to a stage. Thank you.
Amazing. That was Jack Andraka, who actually invented the non-invasive paper sensor to detect pancreatic, ovarian, and lung cancer. This particular item is 3 cents, and it can work to diagnose those conditions in 5 minutes. No specialized training or bulky equipment needed. I did go back to tonight's Wise Women Media .posteris.com, and for that, this particular blog post for tonight, I put a link to the video, and I also put a link to the article about this young 15-year-old man. The article was in the Huffington Post earlier this year. So I'm going to play us out a little bit with a song by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. It's a cover of the song Soundgarden by Soundgarden called Black Hole Sun. And you all have a great rest of the week. Don't forget to hit us up at the WePay link at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. And we'll see you next week at the same time, same place. Thank you. Good night.